Now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Good afternoon. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Friday edition of It's Your Turn here on WISR. Friday already. Yeah, I kind of like having the holidays in the middle of the week. You know, you got Christmas and New Year's both on a Wednesday. You celebrate Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, New Year's Eve, New Year's Day, and all of a sudden it's the weekend already. That's pretty good. Well, that will change next year. Ordinarily, holidays, Christmas and New Year's, for example, would advance by one day. In other words, 2 years ago, Christmas was on a Tuesday. This past Christmas was a Wednesday. But this year, we jumped 2 days because it's a leap year. So we'll have an extra day in February, and that'll throw everything out of whack. It means that this coming December, Christmas, both Christmas and New Year's Day, will be on Friday. Yeah. Well, anyway, nice to have you with us. It's Open Talk on the first portion of the program today. We're going to be talking later with a doctor, a physician, a medical doctor, who is in recovery for several years now from alcohol addiction and depression. And he's written about this. You know, we don't usually think of our doctors as having these problems. But Dr. Adam Hill, with whom we will be speaking by telephone a little bit later, says this is much more of a problem than most people realize, and even that a lot of doctors don't like to admit. So he's had some serious problems, but is recovering for several years now. He's practicing again. So we'll talk about that a little bit later, and you know, the stigma of mental illness, mental health. We still have it, which is very sad. But Open Talk to begin with, 283-2525 is our number, 283-2525. You just heard Bob Kupp talk about the famous Idaho Potato Bowl, which is on this afternoon. I got to tell you, folks, you have to be a college football nut to watch all of these bowl games. There's like, I don't know, 40 or 50 bowl games now. I can remember when I was a kid, there were five or six. That was it. If you don't make it to a bowl game nowadays, you must have really had a pitiful season. So, hey, I like Idaho potatoes. They're good. They're great baking potatoes. But really, the famous Idaho potato bowl game? Well, I'm afraid I won't be watching this afternoon. I tuned in yesterday. I got home from work. And tuned into the Birmingham Bowl, another one of those real terrific things. I turned the TV on and happened to be on ESPN. There was nobody in the stadium. It was virtually empty. Now, they did have rain down there, which would have hurt things. In fact, the game was delayed by weather. But I don't know how these bowls exist financially, because in many of them, not the big ones, you know, the Rose Bowl, Cotton Bowl, the Fiesta Bowl, they still get huge crowds. But these minor bowls, if you're watching, there's hardly anybody in the stadium. Looks like the families of the players. That's about it. Well, the college bowl season will be wrapping up soon. We won't have to worry about it. A note from the National Fire Protection Association. If you have a live Christmas tree, good idea to take her down pretty soon. They dry out pretty badly when you get into January. I was surprised. I mean, I knew this, but we had a news story today that a third, according to the National Fire Prevention Association statistics, a third of house fires that are caused by a Christmas tree happen in January. And that's because, you know, the trees have dried out. And they are, I mean, it's like a tinderbox, really. I saw a demonstration once of a Christmas tree that was set on fire purposefully under controlled situations. It goes up like a torch. Just a couple of seconds. I mean, it's just a flaming torch. So if you have a live tree, and I realize that the majority of people no longer do, but it's time to get rid of it because it becomes a real fire hazard once you get past New Year's. Speaking of which, do you take your Christmas decorations down? Pat Parker, engineering for us on the other side of the glass. Have you taken your Christmas decorations down already? You have your tree? Yeah. I never do. I leave the tree up and the other decorations until the Epiphany, the Feast of the Epiphany, the arrival of the wise men, which is celebrated this Sunday, by the way. Sunday, Feast of the Epiphany. And then I take my stuff down after that. For a couple of reasons, I guess. You go to all the effort to decorating. I love to decorate for Christmas time. Then I enjoy the lights and everything like that. So after you go to all that effort to put them up, you might as well enjoy it, right? And there was an article in Pittsburgh Magazine. I have to thank a listener. I'm going to take a minute to do that personally here. Blanche Kind from Slippery Rock sent me a letter. I got it in the mail this morning. And she said, Dave, I heard you talking back before Christmas one day. I was on this program. We were talking about it, the Christmas carols, Christmas hymns, and where they came from, so on and so forth. And she said, did you see this article by Rick Seaback in Pittsburgh Magazine? And she sent me a copy of it, and I had not seen it. I don't read that magazine anymore. Sure, it's still a good magazine, but at any rate, Rick Seaback is the guy who does the really fabulous features on Channel 13. His films about Pittsburgh and Western Pennsylvania and Kennywood and restaurants and the Lincoln Highway and all that stuff, they're fabulous. He's a great guy, very personable guy. But anyway, he tells the story of the local connection. Now it's a little bit like, 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon, but a local connection to the extremely well-known Christmas carol, Christmas hymn, We Three Kings. We Three Kings of Orient Are. And I never heard this story before. Never. So I thank Blanche Kind for taking the time to make a copy of it and send it in to me. I'll give it to you briefly, not the long version. But the author of We Three Kings, the guy that wrote the song, was the John Henry Hopkins Jr. He was a son of his father had the same name, John Henry Hopkins Sr. And they lived, his parents were immigrants from Europe, and they lived in Pittsburgh. John Henry Hopkins Jr. lived in Pittsburgh from the time he was born in 1820 until he was 10 years old. And by that time, his father, also John Henry, had distinguished himself as an architect and a professor and a very prominent member of the Episcopal Church. And he helped to design and build the Second Trinity Episcopal Church in downtown Pittsburgh and St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Zelianople, which was erected in 1826, and is still there, too, that same building, St. Paul's Lutheran in Zelianople. Now, the older Hopkins, John Henry Sr., would go on to become the first bishop of Vermont. The family moved to New England. His son, John Henry Jr., graduated from the University of Vermont, studied at General Theological Seminary in Manhattan. And after he was ordained a deacon, he became the music instructor at the seminary. And for a Christmas pageant in 1857, he wrote the Christmas carol about the Magi, We Three Kings of Orient Are, 1857. He was later ordained a priest in the Episcopal Church, 1872, and served as rector of Christ Episcopal in Williamsport, PA. So Rick Seaback, in his article in Pittsburgh Magazine, said he was flabbergasted that We Three Kings, the very, very well-known Christmas carol, has Pittsburgh roots. Yeah. We Three Kings of Orient are. How about that, huh? What a great story. Great story. Never knew that. Everybody knows the song, the hymn. Probably sing it in church, right? Or you will this weekend at Christmas time. And Rick Seaback also told a wonderful story about when he was a kid. He said his mother had, and he's a Pittsburgh guy, by the way. His mother always set up the manger scene, the creche scene with the figurines before Christmas. But they took the wise men, the magi figures and the camels and stuff, and they put them in another part of the house on a windowsill. And then after Christmas, every day they would move them a little bit closer to the manger scene, wherever it was set up, in the living room or wherever. And Rick Seaback said it was really kind of neat, you know. They'd move them to the credenza, and then they'd be on a dining room table, and the next day they'd be in the hallway and somewhere else. And eventually, by the Feast of the Epiphany, coming up this Sunday, they would arrive at the, you know, they'd put the Three Kings figures at the manger scene. And Rick Seaback said he remembers that very well from his childhood. What a great story. Thank you, Blanche Kind from Slippery Rock, for taking the time to write me a letter on that and to copy that article. That's a wonderful, wonderful story. 283-2525 is our number, 283-2525. I saw some folks taking outdoor Christmas decorations down yesterday afternoon when I was on my way home from work. It was a good day to do it because it was still dry. The rain hadn't started, and it was fairly warm. And we had upper 40s yesterday afternoon, and it was a good day to be taking the outdoor decorations down because, you know, pretty wet today. By Sunday, it's going to be cold again, and who knows? That may be when we settle in for the cold weather. We'll take a break. Open talk, 283-2525 is our number, 283-2525, our number. You're listening to It's Your Turn here on WISR, and we will be back right after these words.
Armco Credit Union has one sweetheart of a loan rate waiting for you. Hi, I'm Kurt Heekins, loan manager at Armco Credit Union. And whether you're thinking of buying a vehicle or refinancing a loan from another financial institution, now is the time to take advantage of our low, low rates. Now through February the 29th, you can get a 60-month auto loan for as low as 2.25 annual percentage rate. Check out armcocu.com for other rates and terms. Apply for a loan online or visit us in person.
Armco Credit Union is an equal opportunity lender and is federally insured by NCUA.
Do you have missing teeth or wear dentures? You may have heard of or are considering dental implants. Hi, this is Dr. Bob Todd of Butler Smiles Dental Care. There are many options available with dental implants, and making the right choice can be confusing. I have been placing dental implants since 2004, both full-size traditional implants and small diameter or mini dental implants. There are indications for both, but more and more we are using mini dental implants in a variety of innovative ways. They are easier to place, causing less discomfort, are less costly, and can frequently be used immediately after placement, allowing you to get back to eating the foods you like or smiling again right away. Traditional implants typically have a 4-month healing time before they can be used. I invite you to call our office at 282-7774 to schedule a free consultation to see if mini dental implants are the right solution for your dental problems, or visit us on the web at butlersmiles.com.
In the state of Pennsylvania, you must now be 21 years of age to purchase any tobacco products at the store or vaping products. Governor Wolf signed it into law. And what do you think? Yeah. Raising the age in which you can buy tobacco products to 21. I have been 18. And there's a company, U-Haul, I think, a company that announced this week they would not be hiring any new employees who have nicotine in their system. They, you know, if you smoke, they don't want you. They want you as an employee. Okay, let's get to the people. It's open talk here. After all, our phone number is 283-2525. Hi there, caller. This is Dave Malarkey. Go right ahead. It's your turn. You're on the air.
Hi, Dave. I just wanted to say that my decorations will be up until the Orthodox Christmas on the 7th of January.
Is it February or just January, isn't it?
Yeah, January the 7th.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, I think that's a good idea. I don't have any problem with that.
Well, my family, my family observed Christmas on both the 25th and the 7th, and I married someone who was Orthodox and celebrated on the 7th, and so I always think that all these people who start putting things up in October for Christmas miss the opportunity to really celebrate the Christmas season.
I agree.
Which is not that many weeks before Christmas. It's the period after Christmas.
We have a number of Orthodox churches here in our area, and from what I understand, I've talked to some of the people there, and in some cases, they celebrate Christmas on the 25th and on January 7th. They kind of do it both days, like you do in your family.
Yes, kind of. But it always it kind of got me because everybody rushes it before it really gets here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they kind of skip over Advent and go directly to celebrating, singing all the carols, you know, after Halloween. And then after, it's just like a big shutoff.
I went to a couple of years ago. I stopped into a convenience store. It was the day after Christmas, December 26th, and I was up early in the morning to get the paper, the Post Gazette, and I stopped into the Get-Go, the neighborhood Get-Go, and I was surprised because this is like 7:30 in the morning, the day after Christmas. And they had already taken the Christmas music off their, you know, their sound system that they play throughout the store. They were already back to rock and roll. And I thought, my goodness, it's the day after Christmas. What are you doing here?
That's what I mean. It's just like it's gotten topsy-turvy. They do all this stuff far before Christmas. So I think it's kind of nice. I understand people taking down outside decorations when the weather permits. Kind of thing.
Oh yeah, me
that's
too.
Difficult, but no, I think it's kind of, you know, it's at least celebrate until the Epiphany, for goodness sakes. enjoy it after it really is Christmas, rather than with me, it's almost you get tired of all the things before Christmas because they, you know, are pushing the sales, they're having all this stuff before the holiday actually comes.
I'm with you.
I just feel it's kind of nice when it's, when they wait a little bit after the day itself.
I'm hearing you. Hey, good to talk with you today.
Yeah, thank you. Happy New Year.
Sure. And Happy New Year to you, too. Thanks. 283-2525 is our number. 283-2525. Is it okay to leave your Christmas decorations up for a while? I think so. No problem with that. No. In fact, I have been to 12th night parties, which I think go back to tradition in Britain, in England, where the 12th night was, maybe still is, a big deal, where they celebrated until 12 days after Christmas. 12th night, right? Yeah. And I've been to some 12th night parties. It's kind of nice. Because, as that caller said, you're over the hustle and bustle and the rush that you often see leading up to Christmas, especially a couple of days before Christmas, and have a chance to relax a little bit and enjoy friends and company and so on. 12th night party. Not a bad idea. Hey, any excuse for a party, right? 283-2525 is the number, 283-2525. On the other hand, you know, it can happen pretty quickly. I was in the store this past weekend, Friday, Saturday, I forget which day, and I already had all the Valentine cards out. Valentine stuff out. It was everywhere. I was overwhelmed by hearts and Valentine stuff. I thought, oh, wow. Well, you know, in retail, you do what you have to do. 283-2525 is our number. 283-2525. The Vitalant Bloodmobile is outside of our parking lot today here at the Butler Radio Network headquarters on Pillow Street in Butler. And they're going to be there until 4 o'clock this afternoon if you want to give blood. It's our Butler Radio Network blood drive. Vitalant, you might not be familiar with that name yet. It used to be Central Blood Bank. And we did an interview here on this program late last summer. I think it was in August sometime when there was a critical shortage of blood. And we talked about the name change and how Central Blood Bank has decided to join up with Vitalant, which is a nationwide company. But anyway, the Vitalant Bloodmobile is parked right outside our front door, as a matter of fact. And they'll be there until 4 o'clock this afternoon if you want to give blood. All blood donors will receive a fleece neck warmer with the Pittsburgh Penguin and Vitalant logos. I think the Pens have joined up with Vitalant to help advertise the need for blood. Blood has limited shelf life. And I didn't know this until I did an interview with some of the folks from Vitalant. You can't, even if it's refrigerated, you can't keep it for too long. I don't remember exactly what the shelf life is, but it has to be used. And so, therefore, there's a constant need to replenish. And who knows? You know, you could be the one, or someone in your family could be the one who needs blood tomorrow or next week. A car crash, a medical diagnosis, any sort of an emergency could mean an immediate need for a blood transfusion, and you certainly want the blood to be there. So if you're interested in donating, walk-ups are welcome today. Again, the Vitalant Bloodmobile in front of our studios here until 4 o'clock this afternoon. We're at 252 Pillow Street, the west end of the city of Butler, about 100 yards up the street from Pullman Park, the baseball park. So that's happening today. If you'd like to give blood, good idea. Did you hear the story today? And I heard it on CBS Radio on WISR this morning. And the first time I heard it, I wasn't quite sure that I heard it correctly. And then the story was on again, I don't know, 7 o'clock, 7:30 news, I'm not sure, about experts urging people when they're writing checks to write out 2020 as opposed to shorthand, just putting 20 down. And I didn't understand the rationale when I first heard it because, do you still write checks? I do, a couple a month. Some things I now pay, electronically, but still a few checks that I write. And, forever, since I first had a checking account, you would write, today, for example, 1/3 /20, or whatever year it was, last year, 12, 25, 19. Well, the difference is, and this is at least according to the experts, that if you would write, for example, today, 1/3/20, then someone later could change the date. All they'd have to do is add two more digits, 20, they could put 25, 27, whatever. Because the actual year is the same as the century, 2020. Now, I don't I'm certainly no legal expert, so I would not be the one to make a final judgment, but I can't see where this is that big of a deal. I'm as concerned as anybody about identity theft and bad guys and all that stuff, but my first question would be, okay, so what if somebody adds a couple of digits after your 1320? So you can't cash the check until next year or 3 years down the road? Okay. That's not going to be a great disaster. I don't understand how that lets somebody get into your checking account. So I guess I need more explanation on that. And I understand how you could simply add two more digits, but it's not like you can go backwards. I don't know. I guess be a good idea. I don't know whether I'm going to change or not. I've been doing it that way for too many years. And it's mostly on checks. There are other times that you write down a date that I guess you wouldn't have to worry. 283-2525 is on. Another thing to worry about, huh? Wow. And then there's a situation in Iraq with the United States military assassinating the Iranian general at Baghdad International Airport yesterday. Where is that going to lead? Who knows? Who knows? Hopefully not to wider confrontation, but Pentagon officials say this guy was a mastermind behind some previous killings and was planning more attacks on American service personnel. And of course, we had the storming of the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad earlier this week. But at any rate, this guy was taken out yesterday with a smart bomb at Baghdad International Airport. Iran, who is one of their top generals in Iraq, but Iranian general, the Iranian government has pledged revenge. I guess the biggest concern, initially at least, is that they would authorize an attack on Israel. And so Israelis are on high alert today in the wake of this assassination that the U.S. carried out. So we'll see what happens. Keep your fingers crossed. It's such a mess, isn't it, in the Middle East? And we have been in there now we've been in Afghanistan for 15 years. 15 years. A lot of folks wonder what we're still doing there, 283-2525 is our number. Open talk. Hi, caller. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn. You're on the air.
Hey, Dave. Sorry I didn't get that Christmas card out to you. I just ran out of gas while I was doing them. But
that's okay.
I spent about a half hour at each card, so.
That's fine. But
anyhow, the whole thing with Iran, who okayed that?
President Trump.
Okay, I know he doesn't have a crack team of advisors, and he knows more than the generals. To me, it just seems kind of careless and reckless.
Well, you could, I would respect your opinion on that, but in terms of the president, giving the go-ahead, that's happened in the past. It was President Obama who gave the go-ahead to take out Bin Laden, if you remember.
But he was in a war room, and there was all these people there, that different people from different branches of the government, and kind of seems like he came out of nowhere.
Yeah, well, I can see the distinction that you make. It worries me. There's no question about it.
If you're in Israel, you have to worry. But, there's soft targets everywhere that they can retaliate. It doesn't really have to be like a shooting war, just a war of attrition where you just, hit soft targets around the globe.
Oil tankers, in the Straits of Hormuz over there, yeah.
And, you know, volunteers, just peep tourists, yeah. You know.
Well, anybody that's a tourist and goes to, Iran, I don't know. I think they need their head examined, really.
Yeah, well, the weird thing is, Iran is actually a very pro-Western country as far as the Middle East goes, more so than, say, Saudi Arabia. So I think we might be picking the wrong side here over Saudi Arabia or Iran.
Yeah, and yet we're buddy-buddies with Saudi Arabia and just the opposite with Iran, I hear you.
Yeah, and they're not a shining example of democracy, I'll tell you that.
By no means.
But, all right, I'll let somebody else put their 2 cents in.
Thanks, my friend. Happy New Year to you.
Yeah, you too. Yeah, thanks.
Good to talk with you. We'll take a break. We're scheduled to chat coming up with physician, medical doctor Adam Hill. Do doctors face problems like the rest of us with depression, suicidal thoughts, addiction? Yes, they do. And Dr. Adam Hill is one of those. We will talk to him in just a couple of minutes here on the Friday edition of It's Your Turn on WISR. Stick around. We'll be right back. Miller's Shoes, 215 South Main Street in downtown Butler. Folks, you talk about tradition. You realize Miller's Shoes has been in downtown Butler for well over 120 years now. Yeah, that's tradition. That's staying power. Miller's Shoes, your headquarters for shoes for all members of the family. If you're looking for athletic shoes, they've got them for men, women, teens, kids, and they've got all the famous brands, too, right there under one roof. Miller's Shoes has Nike, New Balance, Saucony, Rockport, Keds, Skechers, Easy Spirit, Asics, ProPet, and more. Athletic shoes for the whole family. They've also got Rockport shoes and Trotters and Hush Puppies and many other famous name brands as well. Easy Spirit. And they're your local headquarters for America's favorite comfort shoes, SAS. You'll find them for men and women in a variety of styles and colors at Miller's Shoes. You can always count on that great Miller's fit, too. And a friendly smile from the Ciprians. Miller's Shoes. Headquarters for shoes for the entire family, 215 South Main Street in downtown Butler, Miller's Shoes. Time for a checkup for your pet. We recommend Suburban Animal Clinic. Or maybe Fido or Tabby's not feeling so well. Suburban Animal Clinic, a small animal veterinary practice located Route 8 south of Butler at the intersection with Thorncrest Drive. It's about 5 miles south of Butler. Suburban Animal Clinic, in the spirit of Dr. Dennis Damon. Their services include wellness checks for your pet, of course, also emergency care. They have laser therapy, dental available, also prescription diets. You know, one of the things that are problems for a lot of our pets these days, being overweight. Microchipping, they can handle that as well. Suburban Animal Clinic, Route 8, south of Butler. If you're headed south from Butler toward Pittsburgh, as soon as you pass all the auto dealerships, start looking on your left. That's Suburban Animal Clinic, Route 8 South at Thorncrest Drive. Going to be talking about a serious subject, listeners, on the It's Your Turn program here next. I'm Dave Malarkey, if you're just joining us. And our guest with us by telephone is Dr. Adam Hill, M.D., and he is going to share his story of a physician recovering from addiction and depression. First of all, Dr. Hill, it's great to have you with us here today. It's important that we talk about this subject. Would you agree?
Yes, it is, and I really appreciate the opportunity. Thanks for having me.
We've learned a lot over the past, especially in the past decade. I don't know about other parts of the country, but here in western Pennsylvania, we've really had our eyes opened about addiction, particularly with opioids. But I didn't realize until I got a copy of your book, Long Walk Out of the Woods, that addiction and depression were major problems among medical professionals. That comes as a bit of a surprise to me, Doctor.
Yeah, it is. And I think that for several decades, we've kind of hidden it away in the shadows and not talked openly about it. And even at times put up obstacles and barriers in the way for professionals to speak about their own mental health and addiction in a way that they didn't could do that safely and not feel like they'd be punished. And so we've created this epidemic of suicide and untreated mental health and addiction in our professional communities, and I think it actually goes farther beyond just medicine, but in the teaching profession and lawyers, pilots, veterinarians, dentists, where people are just often shamed and scared about seeking help, fear of losing their professional careers.
Let's talk a little bit about your book, Long Walk Out of the Woods. Can you tell us the structure here? Are you just generally telling your story of how you developed these problems and then how you were able to recover from them?
I think I try to do a little bit of both, and kind of a mix between a memoir of my experience and story, and starting with depression earlier on in my life and some social anxiety and how it all spiraled into active alcoholism while working in the medical career. But I also really just try to expand upon it into what I've learned about being a human being in recovery and the stories that we tell about each other, the stories that we tell about ourselves. And there's so many pieces of our shared humanity within those stories, and how each story deserves an empathic and compassionate ear. And so I try to do that because I've been privileged to be a healthcare professional and invited into those stories of other people. And so I want to be a vessel to help other people get the help and treatment that they need to, no matter what your station or walk of life.
A little bit more about our guest, listeners, Dr. Adam B. Hill, MD, completed his medical training at Indiana University School of Medicine and a pediatric residency program at St. Louis University's Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. He is a Duke University-trained pediatric oncologist and currently practices as a pediatric palliative care faculty physician at Indiana University. Pediatric oncology, doctor. So you were dealing with kids with childhood cancer, right?
That's correct. And in my current sort of day job as a palliative care physician, I see not just children and families that are going through cancer, but a myriad of different complex medical conditions that may be life-threatening or life-shortening. So it can be intense work, but also a privilege to do it.
Early in your book, you talk about a story of your severe depression one day when you walked out of a hospital having just watched a young child die of cancer. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I really kind of at that point in the opening salvo of the book and opening passages was the moment in space and time where I'd started to feel broken and empty and like I'd lost my own identity and sort of sacrificed who I was to my medical career and just had seen myself as a physician and a physician only. And so when things didn't go well in the conceptualization of how I defined success, meaning, you know, a patient died, I took that personally and it became this hit to my personal integrity. And seeing that over and over again and that I didn't have any ability to change that, I started feeling more and more helpless and like I couldn't make a difference in what was I doing and who am I in this spiral. And sort of had culminated after about 10 years of working in medicine in that moment, and that's when I started to explore active plans to end my own life.
When did you begin to have an alcohol problem, a drinking problem, doctor? Was that much earlier in your life?
I think any alcoholic would look back over their life and view different points in time so they realize that they had a problem. For me, I never was a healthy drinker, even back into my youth, but I was a binge drinker and I rarely drank, you know, in college and medical school, and so it didn't really surface as a problem, but I always had an unhealthy relationship where I would use alcohol to mask my emotional insecurities or my feelings or to numb myself away from complex emotions. But it wasn't until really kind of about 5 or 6 years into to my career and in fellowship training that I started drinking every day and escalating that drinking from a few drinks to a handful to a fifth of vodka every night just to fall asleep.
You start out your book in this way. My name is Adam. I'm a human being, recovering alcoholic and mental health patient, and of course also a husband, father, and a physician. I want to talk about the fact that you're a doctor. You know, most folks, they look at physicians as, I don't know, maybe even kind of supernatural. You know, when you start out saying, I'm a human being, that means a lot to me, because sometimes we don't see the human side of our doctors, do we?
Yeah, I think that's one of the main reasons I wrote this story, was to sort of break down some of that pretense and this separation of ideology that happens, that we're all humans and these are human conditions and human stories, and we all have different aspects of suffering in our life. And so I spend a lot of my medical career trying to demystify that and destigmatize it so we can have a normal conversation about what it means to go through these conditions. And it's not about your, you know, what your backstory is, your ethnicity, your cultural, your sexual orientation, your religious beliefs, or your career, but really that we've, you know, so many people are affected and touched by mental health and addiction worldwide, and we should be having candid, open conversations about that.
I must say, before I got a copy of your book, the only thing that I'd really heard about in terms of incredible stress and resultant problems was for people that were in the tail end of medical school, whenever they were doing their residency programs. You know, I've seen these stories of incredibly long hours and trying to grab 10 minutes of sleep on a couch somewhere in a hospital. Are those stories really true? Is residency that stressful, generally speaking?
I think it is, and there have been efforts in the last decade to address some of the things like work hours and how many hours you can be on call and work continuously and have breaks and days off, and there have been efforts to address some of those things in really positive ways. I think one of the things that we've still failed to address is our simple humanity and the fact that we're going through immense trauma and events that are salient and sometimes long-lasting scars of seeing deaths and tragedy and unexpected outcomes, or even events where medical errors are involved, and not having spaces to talk about that safely and debrief. And, you know, I had written in the book, too, about one of the first weeks in medical school being asked to, you know, saw into a human being's skull of a cadaver, and how complex of an emotional exercise that was, and we never talked about it, and where do you put that? And for a lot of us, we just bury it down deep and move on, because that's the expectation to do and to grind through the experience and on to the next year and things will be better. And I don't think we've done a well enough job of really exploring that, the complexity of the emotional baggage that it carries working in such a field.
I've heard that physicians have to kind of categorize things, and I don't have any personal experience, and no one in my family that's involved in the medical profession, but I've heard that that's how doctors try to deal with these things. Obviously, they encounter some you know, very sad situations, and they try to shut the door on that at the end of the workday. Not very easy to do, I guess, especially in your chosen specialty, pediatric oncology. My goodness, how could you possibly do that, huh?
Yeah, I think it is difficult for a lot of people, and we haven't done well enough at training people how to separate the two and how to build safe boundaries and have healthy limits and how to set expectations for yourself and how to really address, you know, being a person, potentially raising a family, being a spouse, being a brother, sister, as well as being in this profession, and what do healthy boundaries look like. I think that the expectation from a career like this, and I'm not just pretending it's medical career. This is so many careers out there, is that it'll take and take and take and want more of you and more expectations unless you have a way to concretely separate the two. And a lot of what I talk about in the second half of the book is how sort of I've done that and rebuilt a healthy relationship with my career and been successful at the same time, so that I can be, as you said, a human being first.
I want to talk about your recovery. We need to take a quick break here, so we'll pause and then pick up our conversation with Dr. Adam B. Hill, MD, and his book, Long Walk Out of the Woods. You're listening to It's Your Turn here on WISR. We'll be right back. The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler.
Hi, this is Howie Pinckney with Pinckney Capital Management in Portersville. Today, many people need help managing their investments. The investment options available today can be confusing. If you would like to talk to someone for help, why not call me for an appointment? Howie Pinckney at Pinckney Capital Management, 1284 Perry Highway, Portersville, Pennsylvania. My telephone number is 724-368-4224. Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network. Member FINRA, SIPC, a registered investment advisor.
Welcome back. I'm Dave Malarkey, and on this segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR, we're chatting with physician Adam B. Hill, MD. Dr. Hill has written a book entitled Long Walk Out of the Woods, A Physician's Story of Addiction, Depression, Hope, and Recovery. Doctor, let's talk a little bit about recovery. How does your book address that?
I think I've sort of had broken this book down into how I got to the point of being in really the depths of despair and having an active suicidal plan, but then getting into this, or having this moment of grace in my life where my wife reached out to me and it started this long, sometimes difficult, fractured, but beautiful road to recovery of getting into professional treatment programs and a therapist and psychiatrist, as well as building a support network in an AA community and having people that could help me, you know, walk this road. And hasn't always been easy. I had a relapse early in my recovery process, but I'm coming up now on 6 years of sobriety and doing it one day at a time, and continue to invest in my recovery first so that I can then take care of other people, and including not just my career, but my family and my children and the people that I love.
You said earlier that you had a period of suicidal thoughts, and you were also hard hit emotionally because one of your mentors, I understand, did take his own life. Can you talk about that a little bit, Doctor?
Yeah, actually, in my course of my medical career, I've lost six colleagues to suicide, and we've had this evolving epidemic of suicide in medicine that has been very scarcely talked about until recent years. And so, you know, I was years into my own recovery when I lost another colleague to suicide. And at that time, to me, I'd been 3-4 years into this recovery process, and I felt like I couldn't help people grieve and process in a way that felt authentic to me, because I was still hiding away my truth that I had this past lived experience. I wasn't open about my recovery at the time. And it was really after that loss that it sparked this this moment for me that I needed to start telling my story so that hopefully it could help other people who were suffering or struggling in silence in a way that they wouldn't feel alone. And so that was a huge moment in my life, and really since then, over the last three and a half years, I've been able to really speak my truth and live authentically and share my story in a way that I hope, you know, helps other people.
How about it, listeners? Have you ever thought of your doctor, your primary care physician, or a specialist that you may be seeing as a human being, and not just a doctor, but a human being who will be battling the same problems that many of us battle in terms of depression, maybe alcohol addiction, maybe mental health problems? Well, they do, and it's far more widespread than I realized, that's for sure. I guess I find it difficult to believe that. I mean, in the general population, I know there's a tendency to not talk about mental health issues because of a stigma involved. But I guess I didn't realize that that was the case among many medical professionals as well, Doctor. And obviously you make the case for that, do you not?
Yeah, it's very, very real and true. And you know, I talk about in the book how we've even created these barriers. And I was sort of publicly shamed, even though I came forth voluntarily with my own recovery and sought treatment and had been successful in recovery, but was but still my medical license was put on probation. I was asked to write a letter apologizing to be published in a public newsletter about my addiction, and that archaic sense of public shaming that we still do in modern times about addiction and mental health is something that significantly needs to change. And if we're the ones as medical professionals treating these conditions and recommending treatment paths, then how sadly ironic that we're the ones who are, you know, often delving out these punishments to individuals who seek treatment, and it sends this horrifying message to people under our care. And so, you know, we have to do better. And I'm trying to be a small voice in the push for change that'll make that better, not just for people in this career, but for all the people under our care as well.
For a long time, the general population looked at addiction and addicts, you know, as a problem with a lack of willpower. We've learned a lot more, even in the past decade or two, about addiction and the effect on brain chemistry that it has. It's not just a lack of willpower, and we know that now, don't we?
That's right. And you know, we know that this is a medical condition just like any other. And you know, we've long had this separation of mental health and psychiatric conditions as feeling or being or treated differently than physical health conditions. Well, the mind-body experience is that they're all the same, and therefore we should, you know, treat them the same. And so there has been a lot of headway made in the last several decades in terms of the medical treatments of such, but I think we still have a long way to go in terms of how we talk about it socially and culturally in a way that doesn't sensationalize or tie mental health into these pathways of violence or harm or, you know, mass shootings or incarceration, or that we've created this dialogue that really creates this false message that has done a lot of harm and takes a lot of effort and a lot of people telling their individual stories to, I think, detangle that web of mess that we've made.
Yeah, from what I've read, the vast majority of people who are battling a mental health condition are far more likely to be a victim of a crime than a perpetrator.
Well, I think that can be true for individuals who have, you know, severe forms of ongoing mental health treatment, but even more so true than that is 20% of the general population, you know, has some form of a mental health diagnosis or condition. And so, you know, people every day that are functional, working normally, living happy, healthy lives also have diagnoses, and you wouldn't ever know it. And I think we've, you know, tend to just isolate this far extremist vision of what a mental health condition looks like and then, like I said, sensationalize it. But the truth is, it's a very common, relatively normal, everybody has somebody that they know that has some form of a mental health condition. And so I think we should talk about it as such, as a very normal condition that lives, walks amongst us every day.
But still we have that stigma, do we not? I mean, I can't imagine if you had been battling, chicken pox or whatever, you certainly wouldn't have had to go through the what you went through as you tried to come back to active practice because of mental illness, right?
No, that's right. That's absolutely correct. And I think that's indeed what we have to change is addressing the stigma, but also addressing on a policy level, on a way that we look at what disability means in this country, is a way that we don't discriminate against people that have health conditions, that we have to rewrite policies, we have to rewrite what, you know, short and long-term disability look like. We have to rewrite credentialing processes and how people get their jobs, and not ask intrusive questions about, have you ever been treated for a mental health condition, on job employment paperwork, which happens in the medical career every single day. And, you know, you can't ask somebody if they have a physical health condition. It would be openly discriminatory, but we still do that in the medical profession. So, you know, from a policy level, these things have to change. And then I think and I hope, with more people telling their story and being open, and we've seen this groundswell in the last few years of famous people, celebrities, NBA athletes, the Prince, telling their stories of their own mental health, that we can normalize it and make it a much more open, candid conversation as well.
What has been the reaction of your fellow physicians, your colleague doctors, that you've been telling your story? Have you had any feedback from them, Dr. Hale?
Yeah, you know, I've spent a lot of time over the last few years traveling and speaking and meeting people from all over the country, and it's really been overwhelming love and support. I think that there's just this overwhelming sense of, you know, wow, I've been there too, and somebody's finally saying what I've been afraid to say for so long. And so, you know, we have these statistics that look at workforce distress in medicine, and most hospital systems have greater than 50% of their employees that are distressed in the current iteration of modern medicine. And so, you know, when I speak my truth or share my experience, so many people, I think, can identify with that. And the same's not just true for medicine, but, you know, if I speak at high schools or churches or addiction recovery centers, that there's just threads of all of this that are really just about human experience that are very similar. And so I think a lot of people have identified, and just been a lot of overwhelming love and support.
Obviously, among the medical profession, there'll be a lot of interest in your book, doctors, nurses, and millions of them social workers. What about the general public, or people that are not in the medical field but dealing with the mental health issues? Your book could be a valuable read for them as well.
I hope so, and that's been the feedback that I've gotten, not just since release over the last few weeks, but even more so to my lectures and engagements and opportunity to do public speaking, has been that I think there's pieces of my story that are true for so many people, that even if they're not personally affected by depression or anxiety or alcoholism, know people that are, love people that are, or have been affected by those stories, and or you know, can identify with some of those same pieces. And so it really has been for me incredibly an incredible privilege to see that be a message of hope, of hopefully of recovery too, that means something to people.
One testimonial, in fact, it's on the cover of your book, from Dr. Eben Alexander, a neurosurgeon. He says, quote, "This book is a wake-up call, not only for the medical profession, but for our culture at large." Now, the title of the book, Long Walk Out of the Woods, A Physician's Story of Addiction, Depression, Hope, and Recovery, by Dr. Adam B. Hill, M.D. He's been our guest here on It's Your Turn for the last few minutes. Dr. Hill, nice to talk with you today. Thanks for sharing some time with us, sir.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Sure. So long now.
How do you choose a funeral home? Reputation? The facility? A general feeling about the organization itself? Should you consider cremation? And of course, cost. I know you have many questions, so let Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler help you with some of the answers. We know our business and how to serve the Butler community. After all, we've been here for more than 90 years. A third generation of the same family is dedicated to this service. Thompson Miller provides complete services with dignity in the funeral home, at graveside, and for entombment. Thompson Miller is here to help you through the planning process with advice, counsel, experience, and compassion. Call us, and we'll help you make these important and sensitive decisions. 724-287-3706, 287-3706, or visit our website at www.thompson-miller.com. Thompson Miller, at the corner of East North and McCain Streets in downtown Butler. Thompson Miller, because we care.
Thanks for joining us for today's edition of It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey here on WISR 680 AM. Today's broadcast is also archived for you online at WISR680.com. Tune in again next time for Dave Malarkey's It's Your Turn, weekdays from 12:30 to 1:30, right here on WISR 680.